The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Do you think it's a peaceful protest when people use lasers to try to blind law enforcement officers?
Absolutely not.
Do you think it's a peaceful protest when people throw bricks at law enforcement officers?
Absolutely not.
Do you think it's a peaceful protest when people start fires around buildings?
Absolutely not.
So would you call the attack on the federal building in Portland a peaceful protest?
No.
Do you have an obligation in your job to defend federal property?
It's an obligation and it's a direction from the Congress. It says we shall protect those federal facilities. We don't have an option. It doesn't say we can. It says that we shall.
Public reports show federal agents using chemicals against mothers and veterans. Agents are also using military-style flashbangs that explode almost like a bomb and make people feel they are going deaf. Have you consulted with medical experts about the impact of chemical irritants on protesters, including pregnant women?
We have looked at a variety of our less than lethal munitions as it regards to crowd control and dispersing crowds.
Have you checked with medical experts about the impact of those chemical irritants on pregnant women?
Not on pregnant women, I have not.
I would advise you to do that.
I'm Zachary Frank, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, August 7th, 2020. Acting Secretary of Homeland Security, Chad Wolf, testified before the Senate Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee on Thursday. Wolf was asked about the recent DHS personnel deployments in the wake of mass protesting, particularly in Portland, Oregon. The hearing included some grandstanding and repetition, but we cut out all of the theatrics to leave you with just the questions and answers that you need to hear. It's the Lawfare Podcast, August 7th. Chad Wolf versus the committee with no bull.
Acting Secretary Wolf.
Chairman Johnson, Ranking Member Peters, members of the committee, thank you again for the opportunity to testify today. While many Americans are aware of the traditional missions of the Department of Homeland Security, such as aviation security, border security, immigration enforcement, and counterterrorism, just to name a few, many are not as familiar with the important mission of the Federal Protective Service, or FPS. FPS has protected federal property for almost 50 years and does so at almost 9,000 properties around this country. This responsibility was specifically provided to FPS through the Secretary of Homeland Security by the United States Congress. For over 60 days, federal properties in Portland, particularly the Hatfield Federal Courthouse, have been attacked by violent criminals, violent opportunists, and violent anarchists. I want to be clear. We see in Portland every day nonviolent protests. The department is aware of the national dialogue taking place around racism and law enforcement practices. And we continue to support and defend every American's right to exercise their First Amendment rights. The violent activity that I will refer to today is not associated with those protests. The violent activity we see occurring between midnight and 5 a.m. began roughly around May 28th, with the mayor of Portland announcing an 8 p.m. to 6 a.m. curfew from May 30th to June 2nd. On June 1st, due to the level of violence well before DHS arrived in Portland, the Portland mayor asked the governor of Oregon to activate the National Guard to help protect facilities in the city. Over the course of June, DHS monitored the situation in Portland closely, began deploying additional FPS officers into Portland to protect federal facilities. And despite surging over 20 additional FPS officers throughout the month of June, in late June, it was clear we were overmatched. In early June, at the request of FPS officials in Portland, I directed additional law enforcement assets to Portland to protect federal properties as well as officers. Our federal officers have faced assaults from bricks, baseball bats, sledgehammers, Molotov cocktails, mortar-style commercial-grade fireworks, accelerants, IEDs, and other violent weapons. Since July 4th, federal officials in Portland have made 99 arrests, and DHS officers have experienced 277 separate injuries. Those injuries range from minor to serious, to include several who may have permanent eye damage. Unfortunately, what has been absent during the 60-day period was the assistance of local and state law enforcement personnel. DHS and DOJ officers were provided little to no assistance night after night in protecting federal properties and themselves. Local and state officials did not allow local law enforcement, to police the area immediately around the federal facilities nor in the parks nearby, which violent opportunists used as a staging ground to prepare for their nightly assault on the courthouse and our officers. Local and state officials did not allow law enforcement to make any arrest, I repeat, any arrest, if the violence was directed at federal properties. In fact, on July 17th, the mayor of Portland directed that all federal law enforcement agencies be prohibited from accessing the Portland Police Bureau Emergency Operations Center. And on July 22nd, the Portland City Council issued a resolution specifically directing all members of the Portland Police Bureau shall not provide, request, or willingly receive any operational support from DHS and DOJ law enforcement agencies. To put simply, DHS and DOJ officers, law enforcement officers, civil law enforcement officers were abandoned due to the dangerous policies by local officials. The cooperation and assistance our federal officers receive in any other city around the country did not exist in Portland. Let me briefly address several inaccurate statements offered by some as events have played out in Portland. Our law enforcement officers are not an occupying force, and they are not serving as a general domestic security agency. They have been deployed for an extended period of time to one city, and that's Portland, and to protect federal properties. Our law enforcement officers are not stormtroopers, the Gestapo, or thugs. They are civil law enforcement officers who wear clearly marked uniforms, are properly trained, who follow established law enforcement procedures and practices, and operate within their authorities. It's been suggested that our law enforcement officers should not be in Portland if not invited by state or local officials. And while our preference is always to partner with local and state law enforcement, enforcing federal law is not by invitation. Unlike local law enforcement, we cannot be directed to ignore criminal activity and actions, and we will never shy away from our statutory duties. On July 14th, I placed phone calls to the mayor of Portland and the governor of Oregon. I offered the full resources of the department to assist them in ending the violence directed at the federal courthouse. Their answer was stark. It was no thank you, and please remove all DHS law enforcement officers from Portland. Fortunately, the governor thought better about this decision and reached out 2.5 weeks later to offer Oregon State Police support to address the violence. As of today, the full augmented DHS law enforcement posture remains in Portland. They will continue to remain until we are assured that the Hatfield Federal Courthouse, as well as other federal facilities in Portland, will no longer be violently attacked. And while we have seen a noticeable decrease in violent activity directed at the federal courthouse in recent days, make no mistake, there continues to be violence in Portland. Over the past 7 days, Portland police have declared a riot on 4 different occasions. Glass bottles and blinding lasers have been directed at Portland police officers. Numerous arrests have been made, and the Portland Police Association building has been set on fire. While this violence is not directed at the federal courthouse, DHS law enforcement officers remain on alert should it return. Again, thank you for the opportunity to testify today and look forward to the questions.
Thank you, Acting Secretary Wolf. Senator Scott has to preside at 11, so I think probably the cleanest thing is I'll just yield my questioning time to Senator Scott.
Thank you, Chairman Johnson. Do you think it's a peaceful protest when people use lasers to try to blind law enforcement officers?
Absolutely not.
Do you think it's a peaceful protest when people throw bricks at law enforcement officers?
Absolutely not.
Do you think it's a peaceful protest when people start fires around buildings?
Absolutely not.
So would you call the attack on the federal building in Portland a peaceful protest?
No.
Do you have an obligation in your job to defend federal property?
It's an obligation and it's a direction from the Congress. It says we shall protect those federal facilities. We don't have an option. It doesn't say we can. It says that we shall. I would just say that we do see peaceful protest in Portland every day. Every day, there in 66 days of this, there are peaceful protests. That does not make the news. There are no arrests. There are no injuries. That usually occurs in the early evening. Very different than what the video showed.
So when you read things where politicians say, oh, all those protests in Portland were peaceful, and you see the video and you see what's happened to your law enforcement officers, how do you feel and how does your law enforcement community feel?
I would say I have some very strong feelings about that. Again, I think what folks are doing, whether intentionally or unintentionally, is they're confusing two different activities that are going on in Portland. Peaceful protesting and then the violent activity that we see between midnight and 5 a.m. there every morning. Our law enforcement officers are doing their very best. Some of what you saw in the video, very difficult circumstances. They are behind a perimeter. They are inside a federal courthouse. They're inside that courthouse for the vast majority of time. They only come out to defend the courthouse as it's getting attacked. And some of the language, I mentioned some of the language, stormtroopers, Gestapo, things like that. I think most reasonable Americans and almost all law enforcement know that that is an absolute lie.
So what were you surprised when the mayor and the governor didn't provide support to do the job of protecting federal property?
I did. Yeah, you know, I think everyone understands that Oregon and Portland, they have there's an environment there of protesting. And so we certainly appreciate that. What we saw throughout June and into July is it going beyond that, becoming very, very violent. And when you don't hold individuals accountable or you allow them to attack a courthouse and then step back across the street into a park to rearm, to come back to the courthouse night after night after night, it emboldens them. So what we see in Portland is an environment. If you go back to 2018, we had an ICE facility, a DHS ICE facility, for 28 days was laid siege to by individuals. Portland police, local officials did nothing for 28 days. We finally had to send in federal law enforcement assets to take that building back.
So what should Congress be doing to be helpful to you? And well, first off, why don't we talk about this? Talk about the people that have lost their vision. How many and... And I guess
I think you saw a little bit from the video, the chairman was that green laser is what we're talking about. So that's a new tactic that we have seen that our Federal Protective Service officers have seen in Portland. It's very powerful. This is not the laser that your cat or your dog may chase on the ground. This is very, very powerful laser. So it hits their eyes. It will heat up the nucleus of the eye, and it will give you permanent damage. We've been able to address that with some eye protection, but we have three officers that will likely lose some portion of their vision.
And how much have you heard a lot of sympathy for them through a lot of these national politicians? Have they, as they say, these people that throw bricks and start fires and do the lasers, have you heard any of them say, gosh, I'm worried about your law enforcement officers losing their vision?
No, I think that's really disappointing. That's, you know, I talk passionately about what we do in Portland, and that's because of the law enforcement officers there that are putting their lives on danger, that are getting injured. And what I don't hear is any appreciation for that. The ranking member certainly did that in his opening statement. I thank him for that. But I hear very little of that. I hear very little of that from the Oregon congressional delegation. They have not mentioned DHS law enforcement officers, the injuries that they have had. Protecting a federal courthouse. It's very similar to protecting the U.S. Capitol. Someone walked up to the U.S. Capitol and tried to burn it down, you would arrest them. I would hope Capitol Police would arrest them. That's all we're trying to do in Portland, is to protect a federal facility, seat of justice there in Portland.
And how many law enforcement officers have lost their life since these protests started back in May?
From a DHS perspective, it's the one that the chairman mentioned, Officer Underwood in Oakland. And protecting a courthouse there in Oakland. But we've had numerous injuries across the country. The 277 that I mentioned is just specifically in Portland, but we have many numerous ones that have been injured.
Thank you, Chairman Johnson.
Senator Peters.
Thank you, Chairman Johnson. Again, Assistant Secretary Wolf, thank you, or Acting Secretary Wolf, thank you again for your testimony. So my question to you, Acting Secretary Wolf, is would you agree that Department of Homeland Security's ability to conduct its mission of securing our nation really depends on partnerships and trust? Trust is absolutely critical in this very complex mission that you have, which I talked about in the opening. And that trust needs to be established with state and local officials for everything. When you think of the broad range of topics that you deal with, election security, protecting our borders, cybersecurity, natural disasters, all of those things are under your purview. Don't you believe that we need to have a relationship with local officials in order to effectively conduct that mission?
I agree 100%.
So why did that not occur here?
Again, we have been talking, with Portland Police in Oregon for over 60 days. We continue to ask them to get involved. Now, what we do see is local police and state police making arrests if the violence is directed at Portland Police facilities or city facilities. If the violence is directed specifically at the Hatfield Federal Courthouse, they would not engage. They would not make arrests. And again, these violent individuals are staging in two parks, city parks across the street from the courthouse every night. They have tents set up, and this is where they stage out of. They do that on city streets. The fence that you saw there is on the curb, so they're in city streets as they are attacking the courthouse and that fence. We continue to engage with them. We had over the course of 60 days, as I mentioned in my opening statement, city council passed resolutions that prohibited Portland Police from coordinating with federal law enforcement, even in their emergency management center. So even in an area where police talk together to deconflict, to make sure you don't have blue-on-blue incidents, that's currently not occurring in Portland because of some of the city council resolutions passed.
Well, I'd like to read a statement to you by former DHS Secretary Chertoff. I know you're familiar with him. Yes. He served under President Bush,
yep.
Republican appointee. He recently stated that the department's actions are putting public trust at risk and that its response in Portland shows that there was no respect for or coordination with the wishes of local authorities. He went on to say, I believe this is a dangerous precedent to set as our country faces so many threats that require these partnerships. Is former Secretary Chertoff wrong?
So I certainly respect former Secretary Chertoff, service to the department and to the country, but absolutely on this point, he is dead wrong.
How is he dead wrong?
Again, I'm happy to walk you through exactly the coordination that we had tried to do with Portland Police. The mayor, I'd reached out to the mayor on an occasion to offer our support, to offer that coordination, and to understand what's occurring on the ground. The events that are occurring, again, between midnight and 5 a.m. every morning, I don't believe that Secretary Chertoff, as well as others that have commented on DHS actions, really understand what is going on in Portland. I think they confuse the peaceful protesting that we see usually takes place between 6 and 7 p.m. until about 10:30 at night. Again, no concerns there. It happens right across the street from the courthouse. There are no incidents. What we see at midnight to 5 a.m. is violent activity where we get no support from state and local officials.
Well, I, as a result of what's happened in Portland, I certainly have heard an awful lot from state and local officials in my state concerned,
yep,
as well about what they have seen. And, you know, given the understandable concern that's being expressed following the images that we've seen, what are you doing to work with officials and communities that are participating in Operation Legend to build trust and some of the critical relationships that are necessary for us to accomplish the mission that you're entrusted to do?
I would answer that two different ways, Senator. One, what we see in Portland is very different than any other city across the country that we see when we talk about protecting federal properties. We see a cooperative relationship between federal, state, and local officials, whether it's Chicago, Seattle, or any other major city where we have federal properties. If there's threats and intelligence and individuals are targeting those facilities, state and local law enforcement partner with us and help respond to that. That's different than what has been occurring in Portland for over 60 days, previously 60
days. So you're saying Portland's a one-off. Portland's one case. You're not seeing this all across the country. We shouldn't be worried about anarchy and chaos all across the country.
I've been very clear about directed events at federal facilities. Portland is very, very different. Now, we do see targeted attacks in Atlanta and Seattle and other places to federal facilities. They have been damaged. But what we see in those cities is state and local law enforcement partnering with us to protect the facilities and then, again, to hold those that are attacking those certainly accountable. When we talk about Operation Legend, which you mentioned is a Department of Justice led initiative. That's really to target sort of the violent street crime that you see in some of these major metropolitan areas, transnational criminal gangs, illicit narcotics, firearms, things of that nature. And so Department of DHS, through our Homeland Security investigators, are partnering with the Department of Justice on that, but it is a very different activity than what we are doing in Portland.
Could you, I'm running low on time here, but Mr. Rolfe, with DHS resources stretched, what assurances can you give us that combating white supremacist violence and domestic terrorism is truly a priority within your department and something that you will commit the resources necessary to combat?
Absolutely. And we've had several conversations about this. Again, the department looks at all forms of violent extremism, whether it's the far right, the far left, and everything in between. Obviously, we're responding specifically to what's going on in Portland and other cities around the country. Again, in a different position at the department, I had the opportunity to develop the department's strategic framework for countering terrorism and targeted violence. That was back in September of 2019. Strategy outlines the dangers that we are seeing, the rising threat that we are seeing of violent white supremacist extremism, and lays out a number of actions. We're working on that implementation plan I believe you referred to in your opening statement. We're also pushing out additional grants targeting this area as well. We have non-security or nonprofit security grants from FEMA that also goes towards places of worship, faith-based communities that will also protect them against this. And then, of course, our Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency works with a host of partners and stakeholders regarding soft target security and making sure that those are shored up and against violent attacks as well.
So in closing here, I know that you put out the strategic plan, but what you really need to do is actually implement a plan. A plan is nothing unless it's actually implemented. You have not put out that implementation plan. We don't see a sense of urgency when it comes to creating that plan. What is your timeline? When should we see an implementation plan and actual concrete actions?
Sure. So while we haven't published or put out an implementation plan, we are implementing many of the initiatives in that strategy. Let me get you an exact date on when we can get the implementation plan up. I know it's being finalized as we speak, and we will provide that to the committee as quickly as possible.
Thank you.
Senator Portman.
I guess the one question I would ask you is, what have you learned? The coordination with the local and the state officials has obviously been a huge problem. Lack of coordination, I should say. Sounds like that's getting better. It sounds like the governor and others are now working more closely with you. But what could you have done better? The protection of the courthouse and federal building in general, I think, is, again, clearly within your mission set. But were there things that were done or things that happened that you've learned from in terms of potential for future conflicts like this? What would you tell us this morning?
Well, thank you for the question. And I think it goes back to the ranking member's question about the partnership between federal law enforcement and state and local law enforcement. What we've seen is across the country, it works in city after city after city. Unfortunately, what we saw in Portland was the lack of that, and it allowed these violent individuals to, again, continue to attack a federal facility night after night with no repercussion, with no one holding them accountable. So they became more emboldened night after night, and we started seeing some of the weapons that they used became more and more sophisticated. At first, it was bricks, bottles, frozen water bottles, canned food, things that are hard that can be thrown at an officer. Night after night, 30 days in, 40 days in, there's no consequence to them doing that. So then they come back with commercial-grade fireworks, and then they come back with IEDs, and then they come back with power tools. They keep coming back because there's no accountability. So the lesson learned is making sure that there is close partnership with state and local law enforcement officials. And again, we see that in every other city and around the country.
Yeah,
we see that now.
Well, I think you make a good point. You don't want to have this accelerate, and so, you know, getting control of the situation earlier obviously makes sense. And I won't push you on this because I want to ask you about Operation Legend. But I would just ask you: could you distinguish Operation Legend from, as an example, the situation in Portland? And could you tell us how DHS could do a better job in cooperating with local law enforcement as well as some of our federal personnel, including the U.S. attorneys?
Sure. What we are doing in Portland is protecting a federal facility that has been under attack or was under attack for over 60 days. Operation Legend is not directed at federal facilities or the protection of federal facilities. It's more to go again to address that violent street crime. HSI, Homeland Security Investigations, is part of ICE, is partnering. It's a small partnership with DOJ as they go out into different cities. Specifically in Chicago is where we are most engaged. And HSI every day deals with drug trafficking, money laundering, weapons trafficking, and violent crime. And that's what we are partnering with ATF, DEA, FBI, Marshal Service in specific cities like Chicago, but across the country as well. So two different missions. Regarding Operation Legend and making sure that the coordination and the communication is there. It's my understanding that most Operation Legends initiatives are being run by U.S. attorneys in those various cities and in various districts. So I'll certainly take that back to DOJ to make sure that that partnership and that communication is there.
Senator Hassan.
So I want to start, Mr. Wolf, with this question. The Washington Post and Politico recently reported that the DHS Office of Intelligence and Analysis compiled intelligence reports about journalists and protesters involved in the Portland protests. A second story also stated that Mr. Cuccinelli waived the requirements that DHS's intelligence office be subject to a review by DHS's internal civil rights watchdog, the Office for Civil Rights and Civil Liberties. That's extremely troubling. As I've heard you say, the matter is being investigated by the department. Can you confirm for us, please, who is leading the investigation?
Sure. And the department, the Office of the Inspector General, is performing that investigation. I will say you mentioned two different issues, I think, that are being conflated. So if I have just a moment, yeah. I can explain the situation. So open source reporting program at DHS has been in existence since 2011. And so there were three instances that I was made aware of information being put out that also identified media or press individuals.
Yep.
As soon as I was made aware of what was occurring, I stopped the program, I stopped the practice, referred it to the IG, and again, it removed the individual in charge of that directorate.
And let me just stop you there for a minute. My time is limited, and I just want to drill down on one thing. Is the IG the only investigation going on of that issue?
Of that specific issue, yes, I believe
okay.
so. We have internal. INA has also an oversight function that is also looking at that.
Okay, so then what I want to get to then is if you have another internal investigation, given his apparent involvement in the waiving of the requirement that the DHS intelligence activities comport with civil rights and civil liberties oversight, will Mr. Cuccinelli recuse himself from any matters related to that investigation?
Again, the OIG investigation is separate and apart from anything that I would be involved in, that Mr. Cuccinelli would be involved
in. But you mentioned an internal investigation somehow separate.
It was a preliminary investigation, but as soon as the IG picked up the investigation or accepted
that is now the only one.
We have stopped.
Okay.
So the IG.
All right.
Now,
so
specifically what, to go back to the CRCL question that you specifically mentioned, I think they're being a little confused here. So we have raw intelligence reporting, and then we have finished intelligence products. And what Mr. Cuccinelli did was to remove himself if there was an issue with finished intelligence reports. And there was a disagreement between CRCL and the Office of Intelligence and Analysis, it would normally come to the Deputy Secretary to resolve. What he did is he removed himself from that. We left it with the Undersecretary of Intelligence and Analysis to resolve that. CRCL plays a role with that. CRCL also plays a role regarding collection requirements of raw intelligence as well. So I think it's important to separate those things.
Okay.
What we saw in Portland and the open source reporting are raw intelligent products.
All right. Well, thank you. We will follow up with you on that because I want to drill down and make sure we understand it. But it is a concerning report, and I appreciate that the IG is taking it on. I want to move on to something else. As DHS personnel work to protect federal buildings and their occupants, it's critical that they take all possible steps to try to de-escalate any confrontations, both to protect themselves and others. So I want to build a minute on Senator Portman's line of questions about what DHS could have done better. Two of your predecessors at the department, who both served under a Republican administration, have expressed concern that That wasn't what happened in Portland. De-escalation wasn't what happened. Tom Ridge, our nation's first DHS secretary and former governor of Pennsylvania, said that the way DHS officials were acting was, quote, not diffusing the situation, it exacerbated it, close quote. Similarly, former DHS Secretary Michael Chertoff recently said that DHS's forces have taken a, quote, very belligerent, aggressive tone, close quote, toward the protests, and that their actions have, quote, poured gasoline on the fire, close quote, of a situation that now threatens to undermine the public's trust in the department. Mr. Wolf, have you spoken with former Secretaries Ridge and Chertoff? Do you agree with them that DHS should seek to de-escalate tensions when in the field instead of increasing them?
I have spoken to both former Secretaries Ridge and Chertoff. I walked them through specifically what was going on in Portland.
Mm-hmm.
I asked they asked a number of questions.
Yep.
And at the end of that conversation, they thanked me. They said they did not know all the facts.
Right.
And that certainly informs their decision moving forward. Absolutely. We absolutely have to de-escalate. A lot of the training that Federal Protective Service, as well as the specific assets that we sent to Portland, are trained on de-escalation techniques. A lot of what we do, when you look at a five-hour period every night, we are inside that federal courthouse 90 to 95% of that time. We only come out when there are fires being set, when there's enough individuals there, when there's thousands. We've seen anywhere from 500 to 5,000 individuals on that fence line. And at some point, you do have to disperse the crowd. You have to push them back because they will overrun.
Right.
So we do a number of tactics that actually try to de-escalate the situation.
Senator Paul.
The only question I'd like to finish with would be the idea of police powers and that police powers primarily should reside within the states and not the federal government. Do you have a comment on that?
Senator, I would say that, again, Federal Protective Service, through laws that Congress have passed, have given them specific authorities to protect federal facilities. Now, when we talk about everywhere else in the country outside of Portland, any arrests that need to be made because there are individuals perhaps targeting or committing violence against those federal facilities are usually done by state and local law enforcement. So I would agree with you. That's who needs to take arrest these individuals. And work with the U.S. attorney to charge those individuals. Unfortunately, for 60 days in Portland, we did not see that occur. No one was holding these individuals accountable. Night after night, they would do their violent acts. No one would hold them accountable. So DHS was put into a position that we had to start making arrests. We had to hold these individuals accountable. As I indicated at the top, 99 federal arrests thus far in Portland, all of those have either taken place on federal property or within 1 to 2 to 3 blocks of that federal property. There seems to be a misconception that we're somehow, across the city, policing the city. That is not the case. We are only targeting individuals that we see, that we know, and that we track take, violent activities and criminal activities against that courthouse.
Senator Rosen.
So just yes or no, Acting Secretary Wolf, because our time's limited, do you agree with the FBI's assessment that the top threat we face from domestic terrorists stems from racially motivated violent extremists, particularly white supremacists?
Yes, Senator. What I would agree with, and I have been on record, and our strategy back in September of 2019 does support a growing threat from domestic individuals here in the U.S. to include white supremacist extremism growing here. We see the number of incidents rising. And again, as I outlined to a question, I believe, from the ranking member, the department has taken a number of initiatives to address that.
This administration has gutted the DHS budget to combat domestic terrorism, including by closing offices and cutting programs. Does the department have the resources it needs to prevent white supremacists from escalating their hateful rhetoric into violence?
Yes. And again, we have actually increased the number of funding to our grant program for targeted violence and terrorism prevention. We have a number of individuals dedicated to this mission. And I will just say that from a DHS's perspective, we don't investigate these. Obviously, that's the Department of Justice. What we do is training, information sharing, and outreach to different communities to make sure that they have the resources they need to do to respond to this. So the department is doing that. We're doing that in a fulsome way. We have a grant program that's going out. We've increased the number of staff in that office, and we are implementing, as I responded to the ranking member on our strategy to address all forms of violent extremism.
Well, that's good to hear. Can you tell us about the amount of dollars that you've spent sending federal law enforcement agents to Portland that could have otherwise gone to combating violent extremism across our country? You know,
I don't have
an estimate on that cost?
Sure. I don't have the specific dollar figure that our assets being deployed to Portland again. We deployed assets to Portland because a federal courthouse was being set on fire every night.
Could you supply those that budget for us? What was spent on that, please?
We will certainly provide that to the committee.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate it. I want to move now to talk a little bit about DACA. You know, while you send law enforcement to major American cities without the consent of state and local leaders, in the background, DHS is, you're taking steps that's going to harm our dreamers, hundreds of thousands of them nationwide. You know, in Nevada, we're home to 13,000 DACA recipients. Our dreamers are our friends, our neighbors, students, colleagues, small business owners, first responders, our medical professionals. In some cases, they contribute to our community every single day. And the U.S. Supreme Court recently sided against the administration in its quest to end the DACA program, concluding that its termination of DACA was arbitrary and capricious, and declaring that the matter be remanded to DHS so it may consider the problem anew. In other words, you, as acting DHS secretary, have the power by choice to protect Dreamers by preventing the DACA program from being terminated. However, in a July 28th memo, you stated you were making changes to DACA and directing DHS personnel, and I quote, to take all appropriate actions to reject all pending and future initial requests for DACA, to reject all pending and future applications for advanced parole absent exceptional circumstances, and to shorten DACA renewals, end quote. This memo clearly ignores the U.S. Supreme Court's decision requiring for the U.S. citizenship, USCIS, to continue to accept and process DACA renewal applications. But you went on saying, and I'm going to quote again, I have concluded that the DACA policy at a minimum presents serious policy concerns that may warrant its full rescission, unquote. Again, the decision to pursue rescission of DACA program lies in your hands, and I urge you to consider how your actions to rescind the DACA program will adversely affect the lives of hundreds of thousands of Americans. In the midst of the COVID-19 pandemic, more than 200,000 DACA recipients have been working in areas that DHS identifies as part of the essential critical workforce infrastructure. 41,000 DACA recipients working in the healthcare, physicians, nurses, paramedics, and the like. So please consider reviewing this and allowing these first responders, people on the first line, to continue to serve this nation. Thank you. My time is up.
Mr. Secretary Wolf, you wanted to respond to something, Senator Rosen. I'll give you a minute if you want to do so.
So the Supreme Court decision, obviously, that we are adhering to, that's why I put out the new memo, that's why we're taking certain actions. In no way did the Supreme Court decision tell the department to process new DACA applicants. The Supreme Court decision did not even say that the program was lawful. What it clearly did say is that DHS has the authority to rescind it. Now, of course, it didn't like the way that we had done that over the past 3 years. And so my memo that I signed out and the direction I've given to the department is to to continue the program under certain parameters. As the senator said, no new DACA applicants or applications are being received, and then we have limited renewals to 1 year. And we did that because we have ongoing serious concerns about this program that we are working through consideration based off of the Supreme Court decision and guidance. We're going to work through that carefully. We're going to consider everything that the court laid out. But what we didn't want to do is to continue to operate a program that has serious reservation, unlawful, goes against deferred action, goes against Congress's wishes. And as we do that, we'll continue to process and renew applicants as we have done over the past 3 years.
Okay, that's responding to the last point she made. Was there something else she made a statement that you were on to respond to?
Again, there were several. One was the DHS law enforcement officials are cracking down on peaceful protesters in Portland, and that's a false narrative. It's a narrative that continues to be put out there, and it does a disservice to the men and women of law enforcement at the department. In no way are we, doing anything regarding peaceful protests? I've said this time and time again. We see hours-long peaceful protesting that occurs in Portland every night, right across from the Hatfield Courthouse. There's no incidents, there's no arrests, there's no injuries. That is not what is occurring. That's not what our law enforcement officials are dealing with every night.
Okay, thank you. Senator Langford.
I've heard over and over again that your federal law enforcement are going out on the streets and harming peaceful protesters. Are you cracking down on peaceful protests?
Absolutely not.
Your federal agents are being accused over and over again as saying they're not marked as police. They're just unmarked, wandering the streets, and they have no police markings. Do you have federal law enforcement in Portland that are not labeled as police on their uniform?
Absolutely not. We are a uniform department. We have 9 operating agencies. They all wear different uniforms. But all of the uniforms, as you can see here, are marked with police. Some say Homeland Security. Others say Border Patrol. Others say CBP. And others say ICE. They have police on the front. They have police on the back. They have patches on their shoulders. They clearly identify themselves as police. And I will just say, these are the individuals who are out here in this. It's essentially a half a square block where most of this violence takes place. They're out there for 66 nights. After the 40th night, you know who they are. You know violence is taking place at this spot each and every night. And you know if you come there, that's what you're coming to do.
So it's also been accused they're not wearing their name tags. So tell me a little bit about
that. They're not wearing their name tags because of the doxing that we have seen for a number of agents. Not only their personal information is put out on Twitter or social media, but individuals are showing up at their homes, and then their families are being identified. So what we did is we pulled off of their name tags. So John Smith, we pulled that off. But we did put a unique identifier and alphabet numbers and letters on their uniform so that we could keep track of them, the accountability for them, but their name is not specifically on their uniform.
I've heard over and over again that federal agents are wandering the streets of Portland, arresting people randomly. Snatch and grab is what I'm hearing from my Democratic colleagues, that they're just out there, unlabeled, unmarked, grabbing people off the streets and putting them into unmarked cars.
So again, not true. We use both marked and unmarked vehicles. Again, what we try to do is de-escalate the situation. So as an individual is throwing a Molotov cocktail at the federal courthouse, they then disappear into a group of 500 to 1,000 or 2,000 individuals. What we don't do is try to go into the middle of that group. That's dangerous for our law enforcement officers and others. What we try to do is to keep track of that individual and then begin to question that individual or arrest that individual when he breaks away from a group. So it de-escalates the situation. We've done all of our arrests, all 99 arrests that I've talked to earlier happened on federal property or within 2 to 3 blocks of that federal courthouse.
Mr. Secretary, on August 3rd, the Washington Post reported that you regularly talk with the president and Stephen Miller. Have you discussed the deployment of DHS agents to protests in connection with the president's reelection effort and with the president or any of his staff, White House staff or campaign staff?
Again, I'm not going to comment on my discussions with the president or senior staff. All the events that have taken place in Portland or the events as it with respect
Sir, have
to
you,
Operation
have you discussed,
Legend,
have you discussed the deployments with any of his campaign staff?
No. Have all been at the direction of the department.
I'm not sure if I heard your answer. Have you discussed the deployments with any of the president's campaign staff?
No.
And has the party affiliation of particular mayors or governors come up in any of your conversations with anyone about the deployments?
Not in my conversations.
Are you aware of any conversations that have addressed
that?
Again,
I'm not going to comment on any specific conversations that I have with the president.
So you're not going to comment on whether the party affiliation of the mayors or governors has come up in any of your conversations with the president?
General statement. Because I see where you're going, is I'm not going to comment specifically on any discussions that I've had with the president or senior staff. What I can tell you is our deployment of force of law enforcement officers to Portland or in support of Operation Legend are done within DHS authorities and not for any political specific reasons.
On July 23rd, a United States Federal District Court judge ordered DHS and U.S. Marshals to stop arresting, threatening, or using force against journalists and legal observers. I'm assuming that you were aware of that ruling on the day it
yes.
came down.
Yes.
Can you tell this committee what you did
yes.
to inform your agents about that ruling, and what exactly did you inform them, and when did you inform them?
It was of that evening, I believe. I believe that came down in the afternoon. We worked with our Office of General Counsel along with the Department of Justice to make sure that our officers there in Portland specifically were aware of that and provided some additional training along with FBS, and I believe DOJ did the same with the U.S. Marshals.
By what method did you inform your agents in Portland that day or that evening?
OGC, our Office of General Counsel, back at headquarters, liaisoned with a lawyer there in Portland, and then briefed out all of our law enforcement operators there.
Did you issue a memorandum to your agents that evening?
I believe that the individual component heads from FPS and OGC, which would normally do that, our Office of General Counsel, provided not only the verbal briefing but also in paper.
Is that your normal protocol, that you as the secretary of this agency would not directly inform your agents who are on the ground of a court ruling regarding the parameters and the permissible parameters of their enforcement?
So the normal protocol would make sure that our Office of General Counsel, our general counsel, would inform them, and then the individual operating heads, component heads of those additional law enforcement agencies would inform them as well.
The next day on July 24th, a Californian who was a law student studying in Portland attended the protest. She was wearing a green hat, identifying her as a legal observer. She was filming the protest when a federal agent shot her with a rubber bullet near her heart at point-blank range. Was there any disciplinary action taken against that agent?
I'm unaware of that specific instance. What I can say is no DHS law enforcement officers in Portland used rubber bullets.
You have not been informed of this in any manner, even through the news?
Not of that specific one. Again, DHS law enforcement officers do not use that type of less than lethal munitions.
Will you follow up, please, with this committee and ask your staff if they are familiar with this case?
Well, again,
and if that was a DHS agent.
U.S. Marshals.
Sir, may I finish, please? Will you ask an answer to this committee, once you have checked with your staff, if they are familiar with this incident, and if it was one of your agents, was there any disciplinary action taken?
Again,
will you follow up with the committee?
Just answered, it was not one of our agents because we do not use that type of less than lethal munitions.
Public reports show federal agents using chemicals against mothers and veterans. Agents are also using military-style flashbangs that explode almost like a bomb and make people feel they are going deaf. Have you consulted with medical experts about the impact of chemical irritants on protesters, including pregnant women?
We have looked at a variety of our less than lethal munitions as it regards to crowd control and dispersing crowds.
Have you checked with medical experts about the impact of those chemical irritants on pregnant women?
Not on pregnant women. I have not.
I would advise you to do that. Moving on, have any DHS personnel been suspended, terminated, or otherwise disciplined for using excessive force at the protests?
Are you referring to Portland specifically?
Any protest?
Not to my knowledge, no.
Have there been any complaints that have been investigated by your agency?
I know that our Office of CRCL, Civil Rights and Civil Liberties, has received a number of complaints.
And what is the protocol that you have for being personally informed of those complaints and the investigations, if any, have taken place?
CRCL, as I know, is looking into them. The DHS OIG is also looking, has an open investigation as well.
And at what point does it come to you?
It would come to me after the investigation is complete.
My time is up. Thank you, sir.
Senator Hawley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Secretary, for being here. Can we just start by, is it your estimation that the riots that have been occurring in Portland around the federal courthouse are coordinated and organized operations against federal property and law enforcement?
We have seen certainly some coordination involved there and organization in there. Some of the tactics that they use are very similar to law enforcement as well as military.
Why do you believe that the rioters have chosen, the violent rioters we're now talking about, the ones who are firing munitions, who are attacking federal officers, who are doxing federal law enforcement? Why is it that they've chosen to target a federal courthouse? Is there some symbolism here?
I'm not sure because it's interesting because, you know, it's obviously the seat of justice there in Portland. A lot of lawsuits that I'm sure some of the individuals that are peacefully protesting that want to see some changes in law enforcement are taking place in this courthouse. What we see on the side of the courthouse is, you know, they want to burn it down. They're very, very specific about that. They're on social media about that. And again, what I would say is night after night, for 60 nights, someone showing up at 3 a.m., on a site that has been very violent night after night, is not a peaceful protester, is not a mother that wants to peacefully protest at that courthouse. They are showing up for a reason at 3 a.m., and that's to do damage to the courthouse or our officers.
You've been to Portland yourself, haven't you?
I have.
You've been on the ground. You've seen the situation. What have the law enforcement officers who are there on the ground protecting this property, what have they told you, and what do you think that they might like this committee to know?
They are, my DHS law enforcement officers who I met with when I was there are extremely frustrated, or they were, I would say, before Oregon State Police got involved. They are extremely frustrated. They are a target each and every night. They are in a courthouse, and you have these violent individuals that are staging in city parks, on city streets, coming at them for various directions. They know which entrances we come in and out of that courthouse at. They have a target, and it's very specific. So they feel under attack each and every night, and they were looking for state and local law enforcement to step up, patrol their parks, patrol their streets, and make arrests.
Let's talk a little bit about the doxing. You referenced this, and just to give us a better idea of what's going on, I understand that at least 38 law enforcement officers in Portland, federal law enforcement officers, were doxed, meaning that their personal information, including perhaps where they lived, their personal residence was made publicly available. I think we can all agree that this is the worst form of a public, it's really a form of social terrorism in a way. I mean, to try and get these folks, put them in danger, put their families in danger, discourage them from undertaking their responsibilities. Can you describe for us in more detail what happened in that instance and who you think was responsible?
Yeah, what we see, again, open source reporting is information that's put out on Twitter or on message boards that are identified by violent individuals that are taking place in Portland. It's exposing their personal information. But it's not only those individuals. It's also the individuals that we have brought in. Where they're staying, certain hotels that they are staying at are being put out on social media, and we see them, and we've had to beef up security around those hotels as well. So it's very dangerous. It's just as dangerous as being in that courthouse. Once they leave, their danger doesn't go away. The threat doesn't go away from them. So individuals that we have there night after night after night are not only having to fight the fight between midnight and 5 a.m., but also when they leave to go back to their hotel to get some sleep.
And you just referenced this in terms of what you're doing at the hotel. Give me some sense of what measures DHS is taking to protect both the officers who have been doxxed and then others who are there serving, carrying out their responsibilities, trying to keep federal property and citizens, law-abiding citizens, safe. What are you doing to protect them and their families?
Each of our law enforcement agencies, whether it's FBS, whether it's ICE or CBP, certainly have protocols that are put in place once a law enforcement officer's information is put out on social media. So we're making sure that we can pull that down as much as possible. Once it's out, it's very difficult to do that, but making sure that they are protected as well. We have a chief security office at the department that obviously looks into all of this as well. So we're doing our very best. Now, while they're there at the courthouse, they're very safe, they're very secure. We make sure of that. They come in well before any of the violent rioting starts. And then they'll stay at that courthouse until it subsides.
But just one final question on this, on the Portland situation. It's my understanding, and I think you referenced this a moment ago, that the Homeland Security Act of 2002 actually charges the Homeland Security Secretary with protecting federal buildings and grounds. I mean, that's a statute passed by this body, by the United States Congress, and that there is therefore a legal obligation for you to undertake the protection of federal property. Can you just elaborate on that?
No, it's absolutely right. 40 U.S.C. 1315 directs the department, directs the secretary, and then FPS as an extension to protect federal properties. And I think a lot has been made about us sending additional law enforcement. What we saw in 2014, Secretary Johnson, DHS secretary, sent additional law enforcement to FPS sites across this country as the threat warranted. The threat warranted it in this case as well in Portland, and that's what we did.
Mr. Secretary, again, thank you for appearing here. As is often the case, when I reserve my time in terms of questioning, it allows the other senators to ask questions, and most of those questions have already been asked, so I won't repeat them. I think there's just kind of one area that I do want to explore a little bit with you. And it really is the makeup of the rioters. I know Senator Peters, a number of folks on the other side of the aisle were making a statement in terms of white supremacists, which I think we all acknowledge is a growing problem and one that I know the department's not ignoring. This committee certainly isn't as well. Do you have any kind of intelligence in terms of the rioters? First of all, is it a coordinated effort? Are you seeing coordination between, you know, some organization and different riots in different cities, or is this just locally spawned, potentially inspired by more of the national movement? What are we finding out in terms of what's causing all this?
So I'll talk specifically about Portland. What we do see in Portland, or what we saw over that 60-day period, was some organization to how they attacked the federal courthouse. And that was just there locally, so I'm not talking about any coordination with other cities. But specifically, how they approached the courthouse, the tactics that they used, it was clear that they were trained. It was clear that there was some organization involved there, and it wasn't just this natural outgrowth that, for them to arrive there at 2 a.m. with weapons in hand.
Okay, so there's signs of organization. Have you been able to, with investigation techniques, that type of thing, determine who is organizing this?
So our Homeland Security investigators are working with specifically the FBI and DOJ. They have a number of cases open specifically regarding Portland. And I think what we're going to see over the course of the next 30 days to a month, you're going to see a lot more activity coming out of the Department of Justice and charging individuals.
So, again, you just spoke about Portland, but there are riots and very destructive riots all over the country in a number of different cities.
Right.
Without revealing the final findings of your investigations, which obviously you're not ready to do,
right,
are you finding organizing groups? Are you finding commonality in terms of what's happening?
Overall, we are. In individual cities, I do not see, or I haven't seen the intelligence that they're coordinating across multiple cities all at the same time. But what we do see, and I've said it time and time again, violent criminals, violent opportunists, these are individuals that perhaps don't have an ideology, but are taking advantage of an environment, specifically in Portland, that for 60 days you could show up and you could do any type of violent things to a courthouse and then you could leave and no repercussions. So violent opportunists. We also see violent anarchists specifically trying to burn down a courthouse. We see Antifa on social media promulgating and inspiring others to do more violence in Portland, organizing. So there's certainly the Antifa. We also see Boogaloo, and the ranking member mentioned it. That has been attributed there in Portland as well. So we see a number of violent extremists and ideology that is occurring. And what's dangerous about Portland is they have fostered this environment that you can show up, you can do any number of dangerous and criminal acts with no consequence to you. And that's why they showed up night after night on the 30th, 40th, 50th, and 60th night, because they know for the vast majority, until DHS started arresting people, that there was no consequence.
So of the people you've arrested, might be the best in terms of gathering intelligence of what's causing this. My guess, we've talked about white supremacists, we've talked about Antifa. That's the full spectrum of political ideology. Are you finding the full spectrum? Is there a majority, one side versus the other? Are anarchists, do they have ideology? Are they just simply anarchists for the sake of being an anarchist?
So of the arrests that we've made, and it's been almost 199 different federal arrests, we're seeing all of the above that you mentioned and I have mentioned as well. What we are also seeing is that these individuals are trained not to talk to law enforcement. So as soon as they are picked up, as soon as they are arrested, they do not talk to law enforcement. So the intel that we get from them is very, very little. And then obviously we turn it over to the Department of Justice, the U.S. attorney there, and then that process plays itself out.
So from past investigations, do you know which groups train people not to talk to law enforcement?
All of the above, anywhere from just anarchists to Antifa and others. But, yes, we do see that.
Okay. Well, again, I'm going to find it quite interesting when some investigations conclude and we can maybe bring, get some sense, some sort of sense of what's happening here. Who's driving all this? There is something that is particularly evil, which is one of the reasons I put it in the video, the green laser lights.
Right.
Broken bones will heal. Other injuries will heal. You lose your sight, you've lost a quality of life. You've lost one of your senses. And for any human being to do that to another human being just strikes me as particularly evil. I hope they stop. I hope they question what is they're doing to another human being. But again,
sure. just on that point, I agree with you 100%. It's why I talk so passionately about our mission in Portland and about our law enforcement officers, and I welcome the opportunity to have, you know, discussions like this where I can refute some very inaccurate and dangerous information about DHS law enforcement, because what is occurring in Portland and what's being reported by the mainstream media are two different things that are going on. DHS is out there. We're supporting our law enforcement officers, but it certainly helps, Chairman, when you and other members of the committee show that support as well.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Please rate and review the Lawfare Podcast with a full 5 out of 5 stars and spread us far and wide. Be sure to visit www.thelawfarestore.com for all of your Lawfare swag needs. This episode was edited by me, Zachary Frank, with editorial assistance from Tia Sewell. Our producer is Jen Patia Howell, and our music is performed by Sophia Yan. And as always, thanks for listening.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.